many towns. He painted the white charter that we're looking at every day, and so we usually start with somebody sharing a motivation. So who hasn't done it yet?
I haven't.
Okay, great.
So this is motivate this session for listening to what Ray has to tell us about Sadhana, about painting, about all sorts of different things. Let us share together, and whatever happens in this discussion, may it be for the benefit of all beings and for all our enlightenment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Ray is actually going to talk about the Georgian bell. That's all right. You probably didn't tell you. So, here comes one more.
Sorry. This is very bad manner, very rude. So.
I was a bit late too.
Well, but you can. I think it's better that I sit here.
Because there I start to.
Yeah, well, also now we've lost two people, everyone has a chair.
Oh, yeah, that's why, okay.
Yeah, we've lost a couple.
Do you want me to just pull that?
I prefer to sit on the floor and David.
Yeah, me too.
Seems a shame, but.
Yeah, that's better. We can see you better. It might be dark, but we can see you better, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's southern.
Yeah.
Do you mind if
I. Maybe. You give a point to the question.
I'm used to sit like this, that's the point. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. The Vajra and Bell. So I said to Paula, I used to teach a weekend course every year on the Vajra and Bell. I taught it, I think it was 6 times. And I haven't repeated myself yet as a whole weekend course.
Right.
So what we can fit in today will be just hopefully very brief. hopefully just give you a taste and maybe kind of give you a prompt to go and find out as much as you possibly can. What I know is the result of many years of kind of gathering knowledge from teachings and reading and experience and retreats and from all different places. There's not one book that you can go and, you know, Vajra and Bell for Dummies. It just doesn't exist. Okay, so this is a summation of many years. I'll be touching the surface. I don't imagine that it's so vast, the symbolism of the Vajra and Bell. It is everything. It is the entire Buddha Dharma within these objects. So please see it as something of a whole realm of knowledge and experience that will feed your tantric practice, but also your knowledge of the Dharma in general as well. It covers everything. It's a lovely way to encapsulate everything to something so small. And the most important aspect of that really is while you are practicing in your sadhana practice, you're holding your Vajra and Bell. It's there as a reminder. Okay, it's there to remind you. It's not just something that you're holding. It's like I say, the more that you understand intellectually about the symbolism of this, the more that it informs your practice. And that's obviously the most important aspect, is that you gain personal experience of what this is all about. Ritual. You know, tantric practice includes so much ritual, but it's not the ritual that is the important thing. It's the meaning of it and the way that it transforms your mind, that's what's important. So these are supports, these are in Tibetan we call ten. It's a support for your practice. So I thought of various ways that I could talk about the symbolism of the Vajram belt, and it came to me while I was eating my lunch today, literally, that I should talk about union. So there's many times in the Buddha Dharma when we talk about union on all many different levels. We talk about the union of the two truths. We talk about the union of wisdom and compassion. We talk about the union of method and wisdom. We talk about the union of bliss and emptiness. We talk about the union of appearance and emptiness. We talk about all of these forms of union, and they're all epithets, they're all different names really for enlightenment. This is really what we're talking about with union. And the Vajram Bell kind of represent the things that are being brought into union, which actually is a misnomer because they're not separate. We're just realizing that they're already a union. That's the important aspect. But from our, especially a tantric point of view, one of the main images from the sort of the tantric Buddhism is that of Vajradhara. And his mudra is with the Vajram bell, like this. He's dark blue. He's got all the silks and jewels and ornaments. You all hopefully recognize the image of Vajradhara. And this is indicating the union. The fact that he has his hands crossed at his heart is saying this is in union. Well, what is being brought into union? These two, Vajra and Bell. And especially in tantric practice, we can say that the Vajra represents method. Okay, this is the means. And the Bell represents wisdom. So we're saying method and wisdom. So what do we mean by those? So especially in tantric practice, method is kind of the subjective mind, what we are using from our side. So it's this mind of bliss, or we can say the mind of this highly concentrated mind that we develop during meditation. This is our tool that we are using, and that's what this Vajra here is representing, is the method. This highly concentrated mind, an aspect of that is that it experiences bliss. So when we talk about bliss within Tantra, we're kind of talking about the effect that it has on our mind. We can say that we aim to develop bliss, but the means that we do that by is by developing concentration. So when we kind of meditate on ourselves as the deity, or the mandala of the deity, all these different methods, skillful means that within the tantric path, they're all designed to make our mind very, very concentrated, very subtle. And as a result of that, it's a very blissful experience. So we can say that this Vajra, we can say is method, we can say it's bliss. Bell is what we're focusing our meditation on, to an extent. I can see so many problems with what I'm saying, but I'm just trying to keep it basic. This is the object. If this is the subject, this is the object, emptiness. Okay, so we're trying to meditate using our mind, our blissful mind, on emptiness. So when we do this, when we bring these into union, it's this merging our mind, our blissful mind, with emptiness, such that we see no distinction. We can't say our mind stops here and then emptiness begins. There's no possible way that we can separate our mind from emptiness. In a lot of texts it says it's like water being mixed with water. There's no way in which we can differentiate between the two. So this is this union of bliss and emptiness. But I did say earlier, it's not that we have a mind and there's emptiness and we have to bring them together. There's this understanding that actually they're never separate. The nature of our mind is emptiness. So there isn't ever a separation, but due to our my deluded mind, I see them as separate. I see them as a duality. I see them as subject and object. That's what we're trying to do, is break down that distinction. We're trying to realize this inseparability and primordial togetherness of the mind and emptiness. And this is the very realization of the Buddha himself. That he just realized that everything was his mind, and his mind is everything. We encounter this like in the Heart Sutra. We mentioned earlier the four profundities. We say form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. This is the very meaning of that most important teaching from the Heart Sutra, that things are not separate, that they're... that non-dual, this is the word that we always use, it's non-dual. So this is all connected with this Vajra and Bell and the union. And this is what we're doing in the Tantric Sadhana, whether it be deities such as maybe Manjushri, Chenrezig, Waitara, on this action tantra level. It's what distinguishes it is the level of bliss. The object is always the same. The object is always emptiness. There's only one emptiness. But how subtle and how deep our mind can get, and how much bliss that we can generate, does alter. It does change. So we've, at some point in the past, the great masters have codified the tantric path into these different levels. And that's really talking about how much bliss that we can generate. So on the action tantra path, we can generate a certain amount of bliss. But as we progress through the different tantric levels, it's about getting our mind deeper and deeper and deeper, more and more blissful. This is kind of what one way that we can distinguish between the different tantric levels. But it's all about union. So when we put our Vajra and Bell down, we touch them. This is how I was taught. I don't know, maybe other masters do something different, but it's a constant reminder, even when I'm not holding them and they're just sat there, I can see that they're actually touching and that they're inseparable. Right. Yep. Was that on his ritual training thing last year?
Last year.
Yeah. Great. Good to know. So I'm going to stop talking there, because otherwise I will just talk forever. But I'd be very happy to answer, or try to answer, questions.
Shape of the Dorje,
where's that come from? Okay. So originally this was a weapon. Okay, these prongs that are turned in towards the centre used to actually be open. And it was a throwing weapon in ancient India. And these were kind of blades, basically. As you can imagine, you get one of these in your forehead. Pretty painful stuff. So the Buddha actually kind of turned them in to kind of pacify it.
Was it that size or was it a larger thing?
I don't have no idea. I mean, hand size, something that you could throw.
That's right, yes.
So, yeah, you probably wouldn't want it too big, but you only wanted it to go like 10 meters.
Very large one, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one aspect. And actually, you can still find vajras that are used for very wrathful purposes. So when we're using the protector deities, maybe you have a special vajra for your extremely wrathful protectors. Some of those, actually, the points are still open.
But they do have to sell those, and instead of 5, 9?
There's a 9 as well. This is from the Nyingma tradition.
Yeah.
So in the ancient school, what the teachings of Padmasambhava that kind of were obliterated from Tibet before there was this resurgence of what we call the new schools, the Sama traditions. But in the old school, Padmasambhava taught the 9 yanas. Okay, these are all the different paths. And there's all the sutra paths, all the different levels of tantra, and then the 9th one is Dzogchen. And the nine prongs represent those 9 yanas, as taught by Padmasambhava. You also see where here is Prajnaparamita, the face. On the bell here is Prajnaparamita, but on a 9-pronged
vajra,
it's normally a circle.
Yeah, circle.
Which is empty.
Instead of ring.
Yeah, it's the Dhamma Dhatu. It's this circle, and empty inside. It's emptiness. But it's the same, Prajnaparamita. It's exactly the same.
Mm.
It's the perfection of wisdom.
So in Nyingma tradition, they do use the other ones?
The 9 prongs.
They do use them?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. But these 5, 2 dots of 5 on there and 1 on there, these represent so many things. They represent like the 5 wisdoms of the Buddha, they represent the 5 delusions, the 5 aggregates, 5 fathers and the 5 mothers. There's all these different levels of what these are. And then you've got all these different component parts as well. You've got this, should be a sphere in the center. It's normally flattened, but it should be a sphere, which is emptiness. That's kind of what binds the whole thing together. And you've got things like rings of pearls, which represent the 6 perfections. You've got lotus petals that represent 8 fathers and 8 bodhisattvas and their consorts. You've got Makara, dragon, kind of, and not dragons, but they kind of look a bit like dragon creatures here that represent the four powers, pacifying, increasing, controlling and wrathful, or they can be the 4 immeasurables. So there's all so many layers of symbolism. Bell, even more so, this is the mandala palace. So you've got around the edge of the mandala, you have the flames, the lotus petals, and the vajras, the 3 protection circles. And that's these 3 rings, the ring of pearls, ring of vajras, and another ring of pearls. Those are the 3 protection circles. And then all the bits around the body of the bell, these are the features of the mandala palace itself. And then you've got lotus petals here, which are this is the throne. So you've got the attendants, and then this is kind of the central deity of the mandala. So you've got it all, as the whole mandala palace is represented here. But what does also the bell represent? Emptiness. So it's like, yes, I'm visualizing myself as a deity, I'm visualizing myself within a mandala palace, but I have to remember that it's all just appearance. It's all emptiness. It's all just emptiness. No. It's so important, the difference between pride, ordinary pride, and divine pride. one of the differences is that we remember the emptiness of the whole thing. Yes, it appears, but it's empty of inherent existence. There's another aspect of unity, I said, the union of appearance and emptiness. The deity and the mandala appear, but they don't have inherent existence. Ta-da! That's what that is. That's what that's saying. You see? It's endless. I could just keep talking. Does that?
Yeah, that's great.
May I ask a practical question, right? So, one of the bells that I have at home, the, I don't know what the proper name is, the dinger, has dropped out. Can
yep.
I just use ordinary string, or do I need to use blessing cord to
no.
re-thread it?
This one's just got just ordinary string.
Okay.
You can use ordinary string. Fuse wire can be used.
Okay.
I mean, if you've got a blessing cord, would that be an appropriate use, do you think, Paula, for a breath?
No,
an old blessing cord?
Ordinary string.
Okay.
Yeah. I've had three times here at Land of Joy. So within the last 3 years, I've had 3 clappers drop out on me during puja. It's some people, it never happens in a lifetime. For me, it happens on average once a year with different bells. So, yeah, it's, you need a pair of small, like thin pliers, generally to get the kind of the string through the loop that's right up at the top.
Yeah.
Get the string through, pull it through, tie the clapper onto it, and then cut the ends off. Don't try and cut a piece of string to length.
All right.
And then have to tie a knot that's really, really tightly. Just use quite a long bit of string.
And you tie it off.
Yeah,
through.
and then cut the ends off. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And, yeah, be aware of how long. That's quite long, but you don't want it, obviously too short.
Mm.
But... yeah, generally you want it just visible below the, say, you know, 1/8 of an inch sort of
okay.
thing, visible below the bottom.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question, Rose?
Yes.
When we have particular Vajrayana teachings from Geshe Tashi, Sarah in London, he would always say that you shouldn't put the bell and doji down at all when you're doing the practice.
Right.
Unless it specifically says so in the text. And so we kind of got used to that, but I see that's quite infrequently done elsewhere.
Mm.
But then another thing he said, because I can see that might be a Sarah May thing, because he's from Sarah May, I don't
yes.
know. Anyway,
yeah.
Also he said that unless you're doing the point in the sadhana where you're offering the doji,
yeah.
you keep the bell at your heart.
Yes.
So I'm not wrong about that. Is it changing Kriya or Highest Yoga Tantra? Is it different?
As far as I know, not.
Yeah.
No. I was always taught to play the bell at the level
heart.
Of the heart
yeah.
because
yeah.
emptiness and the
I know
heart chakra.
When you offer. And then do you lower the bell at that point when you're offering the doji? You keep the bell below or together?
So again, I was taught, some people hold the vajra here, but I hold
you
it out
yes,
in
yeah,
front and
then
the play the bell here.
I just thought it might be useful
is that,
for people to find that.
And the damaru you always hold at the navel.
Yeah.
At the navel. So this is...
You see a lot of people going like this.
Oh!
Yeah.
All the time, you know.
Yeah, because it's a very sadhu thing to do.
Like
So the damaru is about generating the bliss.
Yeah.
So you should start playing the damaru before you start ringing the bell. Because you want the blissful mind that then meditates on emptiness. So it's a kind of cause and effect.
I find damaru very hard with in a dyspraxic person like me. The actual bell.
It's just practice.
So how do you hold the phone? Because I wasn't like this. So I don't know.
How do you?
Saying that it's in front. I was taught to hold the vajra here and the bell here.
Yeah.
But
the,
you're saying in
the
front.
Bell should be at the level of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that's.
Yeah.
Seems to be the consensus. I can't say definitely because there'd be different like Fembarbara says, there's probably different lineages from different monasteries.
Yeah. But aren't you talking but about the Vajra, is just when you're offering the Vajra, like when you're doing the prostrations, when you hold it up front, when you, there's a specific prayers when you do prostrations if you hold the Vajra up front, but not all the time.
No.
Yeah, that's what she's asking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're just ringing a Dorjeen bell, how do you hold it? You know, if you're just doing the Shabda offering, well, where's the Vajra then?
There. normally, it's just about the bell for like a Shabda offering.
Or, you, or at the heart, like you said. What you said is fine.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
Okay.
Okay.
So
a bit about Waitara.
Yeah, or do you want to say, does anybody want to hear more about the Virgin Mother?
Yeah, I mean, if you've got any more questions.
The hand, why the bell in the left and the...
Oh, yeah. So that's interesting. Yeah. So all the symbolism is... for the deities, it's always the left side is all about the female principle, and the female is about wisdom. The right side is about the male principle, and that's about method or compassion. So this is why we hold the bell in the left. Yeah, the left side is about wisdom. Do you know why that is? Have you got any?
I don't know.
I thought it might be because most people are right-handed. And so that's more method, you know, like you're doing stuff with the right, and left is a little like more recessive kind of.
Yeah. When you look at tankas.
It feels quite a universal thing, the female.
It's the left side, yeah.
I mean, in lots of...
Yeah.
When we learn in Chinese medicines, and it's always the left side, it's like the yin and the yang. I don't know why, but they always do that like that.
But even in reading tankas as well, when you look at deity images, so Manjushri is a classic, so he's holding the sword aloft in his right hand, and his left is holding the stem of a Upala flower. In his left, that holds the Prajnaparamita Sutra. So this is kind of saying, this is me being active, this is me being compassionate out here, but my left hand is, it's the internal process. I'm meditating on emptiness at all times. So when you look at tankas, it's one way of reading them, actually, of understanding them, is you look what they're doing with their right hand, you look what they're doing with the left hand. What they're doing with the right hand is normally the external, skillful means, method aspect. What they're doing with their left hand is normally about the internal process and what's happening.
That's usually associated with male and female too, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people say, oh, isn't the female compassion?
Yeah.
Because that's a much more common thing in the West. Yeah, and I say, but really, male wisdom? Females. Really? Sorry, Neil, but... No. And actually,
we are supposed to have both, so...
It's the union. The union of wisdom and compassion. But this is also, His Holiness was asked, why there's so many male Buddhas and not so many female Buddhas? Well, one... there aren't male and female Buddhas. They're not bound by gender. It's symbolic. And he said, what we really need more than wisdom is compassion. This is why there are more male aspect deities than there are female aspect. There probably aren't more, but we see more of them. Because actually what we need more is compassion, more than the wisdom. So this is why we... That's what His Holiness said. It's not a sexist issue that there's, not so many female deities. Actually, they're the more powerful
ones.
They're much more powerful. but it's so difficult for us to relate. Even in our training as a tanka painter, we study all the male deities first because they're more gross. You don't get to study the Taras and Prajnaparamita until about 3 or 4 years into your training because they're so subtle.
Really?
To get them right. I even did a test. I didn't know whether that was a cultural thing of most tanka painters in old Tibet were obviously men. So you've got this familiarity of body image with a male form. And I thought, okay, well, actually most of my students are women. This was in Australia and I was maybe teaching 20 people, almost all women. So I thought, okay, today we're going to try and draw a female deity. Didn't work at all. They just couldn't do it. And yet you gave them a male deity and they're away, they're fine. And it actually works. It really does work. And it's the subtlety. I think it's about winds and energies. And oh yeah, that's another. Wind and mind. Clear light, illusory body. It just goes on and on.
Well, you can say why we do like this. I know that we...
Oh, yeah.
It's a proper way, but
it's a good one. Yeah. Why? Yeah, we like this. We like it here because we were taught this strange method. To me, strange.
With the face.
So I was always taught that when you go to pick up your Vajram bell, you cross your hands.
Can I just move this? A little bit more.
When you go to pick up your Vajram bell, you cross your hands like this mudra here, so that it's the union of bliss and emptiness. Okay? But Geshe Santen, most of my teachers have been Sarah J. But Geshe Santen is Kopan. He went to Gyuto. For his tantric studies, but he's mainly a Kopan monk, and he was taught that you pick up the Vajra first because it's compassion, so you kind of go, oh yeah, got to have a mind of compassion, and then you pick up the bell with your right hand and you offer it to your left hand. Ta-da! But I'd never seen that until about whatever it was, 2 years ago when he first taught ritual training. I'd never seen that done. And he saw my method. He saw me do that. And he said, why'd you do that? And I'm just like, because that's what I was taught to do. And he just laughed at me. Literally, he laughed at me. And I thought,
But Rinpoche is Kopan. I know Sarah J as well. But he lifts, gets the Dorji first and then the... I mean, together, but he puts his hand to the Dorji. He doesn't lift them both together. Yeah, like that. Normal way.
Normal way.
Well, as far as have you noticed him do it differently?
So I asked him, why are you laughing at me?
Just why are you laughing?
And he said, because it looks funny. And I said, what do you think I'm doing? And he said, oh, it just looks like you're in a rush to pick them up. I was like, no, Geshe-la, no. It's the union of wisdom and compassion. Union of bliss and emptiness, and he just didn't compute it at all. It's like it just wasn't what he was taught, and he didn't really want to know anything else. Not in a bad way, but it's just he was taught one method, I was taught a different one.
I'm going to ask Geshe Namdar, because I'm not sure which whether you went to Gyuto or Gyume. I'll have a little inquiry.
Yeah.
Be interesting.
He went to the Tantra College too, Geshe Namdar.
As far as I know.
Oh, that's cool.
I thought that's where he'd just been before he came.
I don't know. That's great. I never heard of a Westerner going to a Gyuto again.
Oh. Maybe I made that up then.
No, maybe he did.
It was all just a dream.
That's quite possible he did.
Yeah.
He did, I think.
I thought I'd heard that he went to Tantra College.
That's really cool.
I don't know. But I don't know. I will recheck.
No, he probably did.
I'm not sure.
Anyway, can you tell us why you don't... We put it down, we put the Dorji on the left and the bell on the right.
So it's forcing you, when you go to pick them up, it's forcing you to cross your hands, which is the union aspect. That's my understanding of...
So is it the left on top? Or just cross?
It's because the mudra is this way round. Okay. So I think if you're going to go to pick them up, it'll be the left hand.
So when you thinking of union, when they're separate, is that like conceptual? And when they're joined, it's experiential?
Non-dual.
So it represents that too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So when I put them aside, if you can separate things, you can concept them.
Should I do this one?
Yeah. What are you going to do?
It's more of a highest yoga tantra thing. I don't think it's in the lower tantras.
Om Yogi Shuddha Sadhana.
That one?
No, it's not in our sadhana anyway.
No. So there's a point in the highest yoga tantra practice when you're kind of moving energies around.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got your central channel and you've got the left channel and the right channel, either side of it. And you have kind of impure winds traveling through principally the left and right channels that you want to purify. That's kind of what the methodology, that's really what you're trying to do. So one way to do that is to bring those winds into the central channel. That kind of purifies them. So we do this mudra where we gather, use the lotus turning mudra, and we gather the winds in the left channel.
Mm-hmm.
And we move across and we gather the winds in the right channel. Mm-hmm. And then they dissolve in the central channel. And then as they dissolve, we develop this clear light mind that is meditating on emptiness. So it's this union of bliss and emptiness. So there's this separation going on here and here, and then this is kind of bringing them together, and then there is union.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of that whole process is indicated by that sequence of mudras. There's a mantra that goes with it as well. It's a really good question, because that's, at the end of the day, it's the absolute essential methodology of highest yoga tantra.
Hmm.
It's kind of doing everything in that one, in that one motion, in that one aspect.
Oh, okay. Because I haven't done highest yoga, but I've seen that move, I've seen those movements.
yeah.
So that fits with the channel thing.
Yeah, we've been talking about the central channel.
Right, yeah.
Because fast breathing comes into Vaitara.
Yes, of course, strengthening the life force.
You have a choice, you can either do the fast breathing or you can say the mantra. So we introduced it. We're just a little bit doing it. Yeah.
Hmm.
So can you repeat that movement again? So you gather it in the left, and gather it in the right, and then bring it in the central. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you a high yoga tantra practitioner?
You've had an initiation.
I guess it's fine, but yeah, it's this lotus turning mudra. So you're gathering the winds from the left channel, all the desire, attachment, energies, and then the right channel is all your anger and aversion, and then the winds gather in the central channel. So you're in the center with your hands. This is ignorance. And it's all transformed into wisdom.
Okay.
Yeah. Blissful. Nice. You know, blissful experience of wisdom.
Okay.
Which is what?
Which side is the attachment path? And desire?
This side.
Right. We're doing right as attachment.
Ooh, are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what Lamia, how long we're doing it. That's all right. There's lots of different what ways to do it. You know, it's different methods, so it's not like anybody's wrong. You just go to, 50 miles away in Tibet, they're doing it a different way,
Yeah, that's we can be confused, and then we listen differently.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Ignore what I just said.
I learned it. She pays attention, though, I noticed.
Yep, with the nine
inbound breathing.
Yeah.
That the left channel you're blowing out attachment, and the right channel you're releasing aversion. We're agreed on the ignorance.
Yeah.
And but if you blow out the is the other one, so
if we clean one,
let's suppose that this one is the desire and attachment.
Yep.
If I inhale from this one, I'm cleaning this one.
Yeah.
But then I exhale.
It comes out to
you. No, the one you're exhaling is the one that's cleaning. When you're inhaling, you're just getting the breath to clean it. So the exhale is the cleaning of it.
Is the cleaning from the side that I am cleaning?
it's the breath going out that expels the toxins from the channel. Yeah. Anyway, I looked it up before we did the six yogas this last retreat, and where I saw it was right was just to make sure, because I always associated red with right and red with attachment. You know, that's how I remember it.
Yeah, because I had it as we'll stick with that.
But
I just don't want to confuse
you know,
people.
There's other ways to do it, you know, and you read another book and it's a different way, and it's just because there was no standardization in Tibet because they didn't communicate very well. I mean, they didn't hardly even go to the different places because they just had to walk everywhere, you know. There wasn't a lot of communication between valleys, so you find different traditions. And since it starts all in imagination, I don't think it matters that much.
It's like the vowels and the consonants, they're different in Tara than they are in Haruka.
That's right.
They go the other way.
That's right. Yeah. So maybe it's the difference between Mother Tantra and Father Tantra. I mean, maybe in Yamataka completion, it's the opposite. You know, maybe in Yamataka, it's...
but then everything I know is from Vajrayogini, basically, so...
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's all good. Anything else?
Well, can I just think? Sorry, just to. Yeah. So, if considering this, the red one and the attachment and desire, and when I inhale from this one, I'm inhaling this one, and when I expel. What do I expel?
That side is the hatred one.
Okay, so I'm...
The one you're breathing out is the one that's expelling.
Okay.
Yeah. You're not like you're breathing in attachment to expel hatred. You're just breathing in air. You're just breathing in air to expel the hatred, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, is that just...
No, don't be confused.
So do you want to say something about the symbolism of white tar? And sort of either the tanker or...
What were you going to...
The eyes and the hands and the feet.
I was hoping you weren't going to ask.
I didn't go look it up after we had that discussion, but you can say what you think.
I did. Three doors to liberation.
But how is it there's four?
I don't know. Maybe it's a different presentation. But it was, emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness.
Yeah.
There wasn't the fourth one. I tried to remember the four kinds of suffering one day.
Yeah.
And it was a couple of hours later, I realized there's only three.
But there were four eyes, so maybe that's, four, you know.
So maybe they're three?
Oh, I know what it
is.
Maybe it's two.
One,
there's two there, and one here. Maybe that's the three.
Maybe these are the three doors to liberation.
Yeah.
And then you've got four others, which are the four immeasurables. Or I don't know.
Okay. What are the three doors then?
So.
Because that would be one, wouldn't it? That's another way. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
One, two, three.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah, feet, hands,
that's what I just said.
Face.
Eye. Yeah, it could be 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, it could be that, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's three. Three sets.
Yeah.
So what's our thing?
You've got these three. They're actually represented on here as well. The three doors to liberation. So they're what the Buddha said, you have to have these. If you want to enter the door of liberation, you have to have these things. So there's emptiness, signlessness, and wishlessness. Those are the three. I've never been entirely, I only have a very superficial knowledge of these. Signlessness is kind of saying that things, it's kind of a way of saying emptiness. It's kind of saying that, I'm looking at the belt, but it's probably easier to look at cup. The things that make us think that this is a cup, the fact that it holds liquid, the fact that it has a handle, the fact that it has kind of a, you know, most mugs look the same sort of shape. These are what we can call the signs. They're the themes that prompt us. But actually those signs are not inherently existent. That's the signlessness thing, as far as I understand it, which is, as I say, quite superficial. The emptiness aspect is this, the overall cupness or mugness is also emptiness. There is no inherently existent mug. The wishlessness, as far as I understand, is more about the mind that goes through that process. It's kind of the subject-object duality thing that there's the cup, there are the aspects of the cup, but then there's the mind that perceives all of that. So I won't say that because I don't know that, I'm just guessing.
So it's a kind of grasping at the signs?
Yes.
So to speak?
Yes.
So would wishlessness be the not grasping at the signs?
So wishlessness would be the not grasping at the signs, yes. Yeah. So it's kind of, you're saying that the object is empty, but you're also saying that the subject is empty as well. I guess it's a way of saying that.
Guess so. I don't really know.
But as I say, please don't put too much store by that. It's a very subtle thing.
It's in Geshe's
book. It is, yeah. Well, he vaguely touches on grounds and paths because of his touchable. Yeah.
Is it in that?
But they, but they do go, as you know, we all know the list.
That comes up a lot in Kriya Tantra, is that they talk about practicing the deity with sign, the deity without sign. The deity with sign is when you actually work with the appearance of the deity, and deity without sign is just emptiness. In Kriya Tantra they talk about that.
I'm just thinking it came up when he was doing the Nature of Mind retreats that I
But even then he didn't go into the depth that he would do because a lot of people didn't The basic program one, the Tantra one, basic program, that, have you done that one? That's really good.
Yes, I have, yeah, Grounds Paths of Tantra, yes. Yeah.
I was going to ask, because I've been a bit confused in this sadhana at times, when we've got Amitabha, because Amitabha's already there, and then Amitayus appears.
Yes.
Where is Amitayus at this point?
Where is he?
Well...
Or why is he there?
Why is he there?
So Amitabha and Amitayus have the relationship that Amitabha, up here, is the Nimanakaya aspect. Oh. Whereas Amitayus is the Sambhogakaya aspect.
And he's got jewels and all that. Yeah.
I completely forgotten. Thanks.
But also, I mean, if you're doing Chenrezig practice, you should have Amitabha on the crown of Chenrezig. But we never really refer, or I have never seen, reference to Amitayus appearing. So I think because Amitayus is also a so-called long life deity, I think that's probably an important aspect.
Well, it's
this particular practice.
Entity, isn't it? Just the different aspects.
Different aspects.
So,
That's
how I thought it through. Yeah, it's usable. Thank you. So Amitayus would be a more subtle version.
So here's the map.
And he basically looks kind of the same, except he's more, I mean, he doesn't, he just holds, what does Amitayus hold? Just a Vajra belt?
He's got the,
oh no, he's got the
long life vase, meditation posture.
Maybe that's why, because we need the vase.
Yeah. Yeah. As I say, he doesn't appear in Chenrezig practice, which is also Amitabha.
Yeah.
So I think there must be a long life connection.
Yeah, because Amitayus is the long life vase.
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry, which one did you say was the Samgrogakaya? Was that Amitayus?
Amitayus.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
So Amitabha hold a vase as well?
No. All the Nimalakaya forms hold a begging bowl.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. So again, from a Tanka painting point of view, you learn the Nimalakaya forms first.
Yeah. Right,
because they're the most gross.
Okay.
And they're the most still. As well, you can acquaint the mind with the form of a Buddha within a sphere of stillness. So there's not really any activity going on. If you look at Buddha Shakyamuni, Medicine Buddha, Amitabha, Ratnasambhava, all these Nimanakaya forms, there's a solidity and a stillness to them. But when you look at the Sambhogakaya forms, Manjushri.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've got Tara and all these Sambhogakaya forms. There's a lot of movement.
Perfection.
Like the silk scarves.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're normally green. It represents the wind element. And they're
always swirling.
Sorry.
Are they harder to paint?
Yeah, much harder.
I mean, just to get the feel of it.
Yes. Because your mind has to.
Ones,
well, it's great because you have to concentrate your mind within a sphere of movement. And even more difficult are the wrathful deities. So then you've got all this power and flame and rah.
Yeah.
And you still have to be able to concentrate. You still have to be able to be really still within the space of turbulence, not just movement.
So you actually have to get into the feeling of the deity to paint it. Then,
totally. If you do it properly.
Yeah, because that's what Peter was saying about Denise. That Denise, that's his wife, who did the face of the Kurukuli. She often does the faces, he said, because she's so much better at getting into that mood of it and getting the feeling of it and can put that in the face.
Mm.
But it takes her much longer.
Yes.
Where she can just bang out a body, you know, kind of thing. I didn't quite say it in those words.
I'm paraphrasing.
But he just said, you know, he can just make it really fast because it's not as subtle as the face.
No, that's completely, yes. Yeah. And also this is that thing about the male and female deities as well, of just being able to still the mind and be, I suppose it's more then about the acuity, that it's much easier to have a very clear image of a male form than it is for a female form. Even, and it's nothing to do with the artist's gender.
Yeah.
The female form is just that much more subtle. Mm. So it's much more difficult to kind of get a handle on it.
Is that because they're mostly symbolized too, though?
It's because they're symbolizing emptiness and wisdom.
Like Persian Parmesan.
It's just much more subtle. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Compassion is a tangible thing.
Yeah.
You know, as emptiness, as we all know, is somewhat elusive. Or maybe I know it, but
there's Chinese, you know, well, maybe they'd be Eastern Tibetan. The sort of nearly China, the early paintings. Well, I was thinking particularly of there's a very beautiful white tower in a book up in Japan. And it's almost like it's just coming out of the mist. I mean, it's there, but it was in that exhibition, Sacred Art of
Tibet.
The one Robert Beer did.
Yeah,
they're
early pictures, you know, it says in the thing that the, although they're Eastern Tibet, they'd have been very influenced by it. Because Chinese painting gets that thing, doesn't it?
And
sort of almost like painting air.
There are different artistic schools, and the one that is predominant in more kind of calm and the Eastern regions. They have a much more airy sort of style, much
some of
than sort of the art from central and western Tibet is very almost blocky and heavy in comparison to some of the eastern Tibetan stuff. So
there's some beautiful tarons that just kind of drift in and out almost.
Now the Tara, it's funny actually, I was just thinking that there's some very particular styles of tanka painting that you only use for white Tara, generally speaking, such as the use of silver. You use gold as an offering, as a, you know, on tankas, on almost any tanka you can use real gold. But it's generally only white Tara that you'd actually offer silver.
It's white.
Traditionally, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you've also got this tradition, what's called a Ningtung, or a heart tanka, that is, the tradition is that the whole tanka is completed within 24 hours.
Wow.
And it's generally, maybe if your guru, if your lama is maybe showing signs of sickness, or, you know, approaching passing, then you might engage, or you commission an artist, or if you are an artist yourself, you'd actually do this white Tara tanka within 24 hours, do the whole thing. And the power of it is just amazing. I've done one. There was a group of us in Brisbane a few years ago who we all did our own, sort of, we all did a white Tara. It was when Lama Sopa Rinpoche manifested his illness at Bendigo. So we all did 24-hour Tara tankas. Just the most amazing experience. And we sang the mantra the whole 24 hours.
Oh, how cool.
The whole time.
How did you sing it? Do you remember the tune?
Yeah, yeah, I sing it every day.
Yeah, because, will you sing it for us?
Got to get my key, got to get my phone. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha.
Can we do it with you and learn it? Because
okay.
We don't know it. It'd be really nice.
Sure.
We've got just a few minutes. Maybe we could just do it.
Oh, that would be lovely to finish off, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be really nice. Yeah. Then we'd have to remember it, okay?
Oh, if you just keep singing it for 24 hours, you'll never forget it.
Yeah. Somebody got a phone, they can do it. No, we don't have phones.
We've got this on.
Yeah.
So, but
yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Let's go.
Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha.
Seven more times.
You want, yeah?
Yeah, please.
Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayo Punye Jana Pushtim Kurye Soha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Mama Ayodhan Yejana Pushtim Kuryeso Om Tare Tu Re Mahama Ayodhan Yejana Pushtim Kuryeso Om Tare Tu Re Mahama Ayodhan Yejana Pushtim Kuryeso Om Tare Tu Re Mahama Ayodhan Yejana Pushtim Kuryeso
Oh, me too. Yeah, I did too. That's why I asked him.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll try to remember it for the next
time. If we don't, we call you.
Yeah.
So what we did was, there was always one person, because there was a group of us, there was just always at least one person singing. So if you kind of needed to take a break, you could just drop out and then kind of pick up and let somebody else have a break kind of thing. But yeah, we sang the whole 24 hours.
Wow. And did you not sleep?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Must have drank a bunch of coffee then.
Fair amount, yeah.
Well, maybe the mantra was enough.
Instead of 24
hours. We did take a break in the middle, which was kind of needed for some people, I think. I didn't really sleep at all, but a couple of people did sort of just go away and
as long as you kept the mantra going, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, would you like to dedicate since you seem so good?
Oh, so special thank you for to Ray, and I think that this retreat and special this session. And with this final mantra, we can dedicate especially to the ones that we know that are sick and they are needing it most, but and then extend to all sentient beings. And I don't know about you, but I think instead of having commercial things and songs that we listen in radio, if we can start having mantras as our tunes, it's nice. Well, it sometimes I notice that I'm just singing mantras, it's much better than other things. So.
Thank you so much.
It's possibly one reason why your food tastes kind of okay is because I'm always singing the mantra when I'm cooking.